accession number 19106, Reel 1.
Roger Cobley, Reel 1. Mr. Cobley, can you tell me where and where you were born, please?
I was born in Surrey, at Weybridge, in 1920.
And what did you have for your early education?
Well, I went to a small school in Weybridge, then I went to a preparatory school in Sussex, and then I went to a Methodist public school in Cambridge called the Lee School. And thereafter, the war.
How old were you when you left school?
18.
And what did you do immediately after leaving school?
I worked for a family business in Covent Garden for 1 year, and during that time joined the Territorial Army, so that when the war arrived I was 19.
Did you have any inkling that the war was coming?
Oh yes, I was very much aware of the war because of Munich, and that really galvanised me into joining the Territorial Army.
Which unit did you join in the Territorial Army?
The Honourable Artillery Company in London, because I was working in London.
And where were they based?
In the City Road. Armoury House, City Road.
And what type of things did you do in the Territorial Army between you joining and the outbreak of the war?
Well, we had drill once or twice a week, and we had a summer camp, and we had gun drill, of course, because we were actually equipped with 13-pounder guns, and we were, or had been, horse artillery, but we had become mechanized by 1939.
And did you have a specific role?
Well, I was in the ranks. I was a gunner. I had no specific role, I was just one of many.
And what was your impression of the training that you got?
Well, it was pretty scratchy, actually. It was great fun to be on parade with one's friends and chums, as they all became, and have a glass of beer afterwards in the clubhouse. And that was that. In fact, when the war finally began, they took our guns away from us anyway, because they were needed. They were actually the same guns that the regiment had used in the Boer War, because they had actually participated, the Honourable Artillery Company, as a volunteer force, part of the London Volunteer Force, in the Boer War.
So the training was pretty scratchy, and there was... Did you feel prepared for the war?
Yes, I think so. Yes, I felt prepared for the war, certainly. I felt that it was probably inevitable.
And what was your reaction to it when it actually finally broke out?
Well, it wasn't a joyful occasion, but it was certainly a satisfactory situation, because one had anticipated it, and therefore one felt justified in doing what one had done, or what little one had done in preparing oneself for it.
And what happened, do you remember hearing Neville Chamberlain's speech?
Indeed I did, yes. I was actually with my wife. She was not my wife then, but she had been a childhood friend for many years. And we listened to the speech at her parents' house in Hertfordshire. I had already been mobilised by then. I was mobilised on the Friday, and on the Sunday the speech came across at 11 o'clock, and we went off to Elstree, where we stayed, at least I stayed, until March, when I went to an officer training unit at Lark Hill.
What happened in that period between September and March at Elstree?
Well, we spent a lot of time guarding various places in London, actually. We didn't do very much gun drill because we hadn't got any guns. Did a certain amount of marching, route marching, but otherwise we were sent off into various parts of London and guarded ammunition dumps and railway stations, and it's just to keep us busy, I think, really. I don't think there was any danger.
What kind of weapons were you issued for?
Well, just rifles, just Lee Enfield rifles.
Did you have any ammunition?
Yes, I suppose we must have had a small amount of ammunition, probably. I just don't remember too well.
And what was your reaction to doing these guard duties?
Well, we put up with it, really. I mean, we felt that the country was, generally speaking, rather unprepared. So we knew that in time things would change, and they did.
And in March you went off to officer training. Where did that take place?
That was at Lark Hill, on Salisbury Plain. And we stayed there for till the end of August, when we were commissioned. And those of us who went, various other ones went to other officer training units. And I was posted to a regiment. I was posted to the Royal Buckinghamshire Yeomanry, which was a field artillery regiment in Yorkshire, East Riding of Yorkshire, and we spent that winter, 1940-41, waiting supposedly for the invasion. And on the beach, literally on the beaches of East Riding, I was in charge of a gun emplacement with a French 75, 4.7 naval gun, and several chaps with rifles.
Where was that section of the coastline?
Barnston, just south of Bridlington.
And what were you supposed to do if the Germans had have attempted invasion? Did you have any drill?
Well, it was a little sketchy, to tell you the truth. We were just supposed to do our best. We had a lot of troops further back behind us. We had, I think it was 6th Brigade, 2 Div, waiting behind to reinforce our rather punitive efforts. Anyway, apart from German air raids that came in from time to time, bombing mostly Driffield, we had a fairly quiet time.
And that was over the winter of 40,
during the winter. 41. Yes, it was actually in the December of 40 that an Army Council instruction appeared on the notice board at regimental headquarters to invite junior officers under the rank of captain to transfer to the Air Force and do pilot's training for fighter command, and a number of us did filled in various forms, and we were told that there was going to be a need following the Battle of Britain. There would be shortage of pilots. There wasn't, in actual fact, but the Commonwealth scheme evidently hadn't provided enough pilots as yet. And so consequently, in the spring, the following spring of 41, I was invited to transfer. And this is what occurred.
Was there any requirements that you needed to fulfil to become to train as a pilot?
I recall going to an interview in Lancashire before four group captains who were very pleasant chaps and talked about games and books. And one of them said, had I seen the All Blacks play rugby? And I said, yes, I saw them beaten by England at Twickenham two or three years before. So he said, do you remember seeing that try by Prince Obolensky? I said, certainly I did. He scored twice. And the second time he walked right round the All Blacks' defence from the right wing and scored in the left-hand corner. So he said, yes, I remember that. It was a great game, wasn't it? By the way, he said, 6x squared equals 54. What does x equal? This rather took me by surprise, so I said, I've no idea, sir. He said, well, that is actually one of the right answers. He said, either you do know or you don't. And if you don't know, you've got to be certain and quick about it, he said. And that evidently is a good way of passing your test, as it were, as a fighter pilot, I suppose. Anyway, so that's all right. You may go.
What were your reasons for wanting to become a fighter pilot?
Well, I suppose it was the glamorous thing at the time, quite honestly. And also my a girlfriend, who shortly became my fiancée and subsequently, at the end of the same year, my wife, was in the WAF at fighter command, and therefore I sort of had that additional interest.
So what happened next after the interview?
Oh, I waited a little while, and then I got sent down, I got posted, as did 30 others, and we arrived at Cambridge, and we were housed in Clare College, and we learnt to fly at Marshall's Aerodrome, just outside Cambridge.
Before you learnt to fly, was there any other aspects to the course that you had to be involved in first? Before you
Not much, actually. We had one or two lessons on navigation and controls, flying, and not very much. No, like my younger brother also joined the Air Force straight away, and he did an initial training month or two called an ITW course, and but we didn't have that because we were considered to have already done that in effect when we went to Lark Hill on our officer's training course.
So the ITW was really just to give you officer capabilities, that sort of thing.
Well, initial training, I don't think it's necessarily officers, because of course a lot of my brother's student, he actually went and trained in Pensacola, because the Americans were training RAF pilots undercover then, because they weren't in the war, and a lot of them became sergeant pilots. So it wasn't necessarily, it was just an initial training, you know, to sort of get you accustomed to Air Force type various aspects of Air Force life. Sorry.
So it's the equivalent of basic training, really?
I suppose so, yes, yes.
So what was your first experience of getting into an aircraft?
Well, we had Tiger Moths, actually, which is a very safe and very reliable and stable aeroplane. And we just took off with an instructor, and we were told that so long as you could fly after 12 hours of dual instruction, you could carry on. And I suppose over 50% of us did carry on. And if you didn't, you went back to your regiment and no ill feeling, and you carried on as you had before. After about 2 months at Cambridge, we went to service flying training school at Halavington, where we flew masters and then subsequently Hurricanes.
What was your impression of the master?
Master was a superb aeroplane, very, very safe, very, very good. We liked the master. The master, there were two types of master, the inline and the radial engine. We had the inline, and it was a splendid aeroplane.
So you didn't encounter any problems in your flying training at all?
No. It was, of course, the summer, so we had perfect weather. I remember the summer of 41 was very, very fine, and we did everything appeared to be in sunshine, and even when we went night flying, I suppose they always organised it when there was a moon out, I don't know.
Did you fly every day?
We flew most days.
How did you take to things like night flying?
Well, fairly well, actually. It wasn't necessary, actually, because we didn't do any night, or very little, when I joined the squadron. We did very few night operations, because it was bad enough, subsequently in Burma, to see anything in the day, let alone at night. Except, of course, there were occasionally lorry lights at night, which, of course, you didn't see during the day.
And had you changed ranks at this stage from...
We were told that if we were successful and we joined the Air Force, we had to forget all about our seniority and start from scratch. So we lost our seniority as second lieutenant, first lieutenant. I was actually first lieutenant by then. And you went back to pilot officer, and then you started again and went up.
And what were your instructors like? Were they...
Oh, splendid, very nice. One of them was a Battle of Britain veteran, and the others, whether they were sergeant pilots or flight lieutenants or whatever, flying officers, they were all good chaps.
They were all experienced fighter pilots?
Well, they were all experienced pilots, yes. I don't know that they'd necessarily been in operations, except, of course, one or two had, certainly. But it was the early days of the war, really, in some respects. I think they were a good lot, anyway.
So you'd gone on to the SFTS. Was there any differences in the type of flying that you did between the two schools?
Oh, we did it. We flew at far greater speeds, of course, and we did our night flying, which we never did in the Tiger Moth. We never flew at night in that. But no, I didn't. Anyway, we finished at SFTS in November, and we've given our wings. It seemed to be a very short course. I mean, March till November, and we were supposed to be fully qualified pilots. They didn't actually, or they would have done, presumably, have sent us to an operational training unit after the SFTS, but they didn't do that because Pearl Harbor occurred while we were on leave, and we were posted out to the Far East. We were actually going to Singapore, but we never got there. I had, of course, in the meantime, been married just before leaving, and we had three, my wife and I had 3 days honeymoon, and then we didn't see each other for 3.5 years, and it took 2 months in the convoy to get out to Bombay, by which time, of course, Singapore had fallen, and we were then sent down to Ceylon because it was thought there was a shortage of pilots down there, although we were not actually operationally trained.
Was there any incidents that occurred on the voyage from the can split it into?
Well, we had a Fokker Wolf Condor over the convoy during the zigzagging the convoy in the Atlantic, and he was, during the day anyway, he was continually in attendance because he was guiding German submarines to attack, which occurred from time to time. They fired torpedoes, got one or two hits, but not on us, fortunately.
Did you see the hits on other ships?
I saw the ship, yeah, I saw a tanker hit, certainly. And there was a French ship, actually, that was, I think, eventually hit. It was called the Louis Pasteur. It was a rather fast ship, and it was always going out of convoy and trying to get, I suppose, ahead or whatever. I think they got a hit eventually and went back, not sunk, went back to Gibraltar. But the Condor eventually left us because we got out of range. We went right across to the Brazilian coast and then came round the Cape. And we stayed in Durban for about 10 days. South Africans were very good to us, very hospitable. And then we went to Bombay.
When you were in Durban, did you see the Lady in White?
Singing on the entrance to the harbour. Yes, indeed. Yes, yes. That's right.
And what was the kind of reception you got from the South Africans?
Terrific. Very good. I think they were extremely anxious that we would, a lot of us, go there after the war and settle there. And I think a number did. I mean, I know one or two people who did so, although they didn't stay there forever. One or two did. I have two friends, one in Joburg and one in Cape Town, who were on 20 Squadron, and I correspond with them regularly.
So how long were you in South Africa?
10 days. Then we changed ship, and we went on a very fast ship, the Britannia, to Bombay.
What was the first ship you were on from Gibraltar?
It was called the Strathnava. It was a P&O ship.
And you arrived in Bombay when, in 1942?
Early March. And we were sent immediately down to Colombo on a well-known ship, army transport called the Daniera. And we got to Colombo pretty quickly. And we were told that the Japanese fleet had turned up in the south of the Bay of Bengal somewhere, near the Andaman Islands, I suppose. And subsequently they bombed and sunk the cruiser Dorset and the cruiser Cornwall, and I think an aircraft carrier too. I forget the name of the aircraft carrier.
Was it the Hermes?
Hermes, I mean, it might. Yeah, it's very likely. But the majority of the British fleet had got out of Colombo Harbour and gone over to the Maldives or somewhere out of range, because they were very much smaller number of ships than the Japanese. The same man who had attacked Pearl Harbor was in charge of the Japanese fleet, and we imagine, was going to attack Colombo, attack Ceylon, rather, even land there, but he didn't, in fact. He pulled out at the last moment and went back to the Pacific. But when he was there, he did raid us, but we were told that we couldn't fly, and there were very few aircraft there in any case. I think there were sort of two very sketchy Hurricane squadrons, and they had a lot of casualties. But the CO there said that we hadn't got any operational training anyway, so he sent us back to the mainland. We went back up to Karachi to operational training unit.
You experienced the Japanese air raids on Ceylon?
Yes, yes.
Could you tell me in some detail what happened?
Well, they destroyed a certain amount of shipping in Colombo Harbour. They this is just one end of the island. They also shot down quite a number of our aircraft, although our aircraft shot down a lot of their planes too. It was one actually of my brother's Catalinas that actually spotted the fleet coming, and apparently the Japanese had captured a Catalina in Sumatra, and they imagined that this Catalina was their Catalina. And when Zero fighters took off from the carrier, one of the two or three carriers they had, they flew alongside this Catalina and waved to the pilot. And it was quite some time before they realized it wasn't their Catalina and shot it down. But being the Navy chaps, they did pick them up. They didn't just leave them there. They got a different attitude to war, I think, the Japanese Navy to the Japanese Army. And they were taken back to Japan as prisoners of war. And I think I'm sure the pilot survived. But he had actually radioed back to Colombo to say that, or China Bay, wherever it was, to say the Japanese fleet is here about 70 miles from the island. And the chap at the other end is reputed to have said, pull the other one. And he said, no, it's the real thing. And by this time, of course, the wireless went dead.